Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories podcast. Just to kick this episode off, we're going to have a sing-song for just as long as I'm legally allowed to use the clip.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best.
Come with me,
and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always. That's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, title gives it away. I'm here to talk of the stories of film. And I tend to talk about what production stories, marketing stories, release stories, distribution stories, all the bits and bobs, really, that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast have more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're films I'm certainly interested in or invested in to some degree. I do try not to do snark. I do try not to punch down. I'm just celebrating the fact that films get made. They're really hard to make and people manage to make them. And I just want to salute that, really. With all that preamble done, I'm going to crack on with the first of the two films I'm going to talk about in this episode of Film Stories. I'm going to start by taking you back to the 1970s. Let me play you a clip, and I'll come to the story the other side of this.
Now, you listen here. He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. Now, go away.
Who are you?
I'm his mother, that's who.
Behold his mother. Behold his mother. Hail to thee, mother of glory. Blessed art thou.
So this one's going to be quite a story. That was a clip from 1979's Monty Python's Life of Brian, one of the several film spin-offs of the television comedy series Monty Python. The Pythons, of course, were Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones and Michael Palin. They starred in and wrote this film, and Terry Jones would direct the movie. But the story of it goes back to their previous film, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and I'm doing a press tour for that. And it was a press conference for the movie in New York where the team were asked, as they often were, what their next project was going to be. And it was Eric Idle who quipped at that point that they're going to do a Jesus Christ film. The press got their story, but everyone sort of moved on. But the Python team didn't really, because that idea stuck around. And it was a year later that, as a promotional tour was ongoing, Idle was out drinking with Terry Gilliam at a bar in Amsterdam. And they started talking about the fact that Jesus Christ was a carpenter in the Bible, and maybe that the cross that the carpenter was on might keep falling over. And there was a comedic aspect to that that they were thinking of exploring. Now, this was a long, long way away from becoming any kind of film at that point. Also, there was a real reason why there weren't many comedy films about religion, because you are stepping into pretty hot water on it. And anybody who tackles, certainly in the 1970s as well, tackles any project that tries to mix comedy and religion, well, the backlash was going to be fierce, no matter how you managed to tackle the film in question. But this did not put them off. And it wasn't just Gilliam and Eric Idle who were thinking of it. The rest of the Pythons were really interested in the idea, but they also took it really seriously. And they've always been quite open about this, about how they threw themselves into research before they started writing anything. And they were devouring books about religion, stories of the birth of Christ. They were watching old biblical epics to see how the story had been tackled before. And they got the core understanding of what the Christ story was before they came up with what their version of it all was going to be. And it was by the end of 1976 that writing on what became Monty Python's Life of Brian began in earnest. Now, the Pythons tended to split up into pairs and into small groups, really, when they were writing. I'm hugely indebted to Robert Sellers' book, actually, Very Naughty Boys, The Story of the Handmade Films, which recounts quite a lot of this story as well. I do recommend that book. And in fact, he explains in that book that John Cleese and Graham Chapman tended to write together. Terry Jones and Michael Palin would go off and do stuff. Eric Idle tended to write alone, and Terry Gilliam would contribute his own stuff as well. But what they were doing as they started to put the script for this together was working on a singular rule that they'd established, that you cannot ridicule Jesus Christ. And that was sacrosanct to them. That was gospel to them. But instead, what they were going to explore and poke fun at was religion. And as Graham Chapman would explain around the time of the film's release, they saw the film as pro-Christ but anti-church. They were exploring the problems that they saw that were inherent in organised religion. The thing is, they were going to do some degree of Bible story, but they'd already, by nature of the rule that they'd set themselves to, ruled out Jesus being the central character in the film. And so that's why they invented Brian. He's not the Messiah, as you heard at the start. He just happened to live down the road. And that was really their starting point in there. And they were working on, working titles for the film with things like The Gospel According to St. Brian and Brian and Nazareth. And over the coming months, they started writing in earnest on this. The Pythons, of course, were regularly in demand. I mean, John Cleese was in the midst of Fawlty Towers as well, and his fame was on the up. And they were often called to by their assorted agents or by other commitments. Terry Gilliam was exploring making Jabberwocky at this point as well. So they were busy. So getting them all together to actually write a script was nigh on impossible for a long time. What ultimately brought it all together in the end was a trip to Barbados at the end of 1977. That they did have some script in place in the summer of that year, but it was way too big and unwieldy at that point to turn into a feature film. And they needed to have some concentrated time just to hone this down and get it to where they needed it to be. And so they all decamped to Barbados at the end of the year, and they were, all the distractions were then removed from them. And so whilst not all of them were looking forward to doing this at this point, it was what the project needed. And they got everybody concentrating on it. And after 2 weeks in Barbados, they had the script. It was the start of 1978. Their new film was in a position to get going. And the thing is as well, it was coming together really quite efficiently as well, because it was estimated for a start that this was going to be the most expensive Python film to date. And the working budget was going to be in the region of £2 million, which the mid to late 1970s, an enormous amount of money, not least to sink into a British production. And there weren't that many firms in the UK that could fund that level of movie anyway. The biggest player in British film production around that time, or certainly one of them, was EMI. And EMI got wind of the project really quite early and agreed to wholly fund the film. And it's just like, this was just a strategy. Things were falling into place. They had a script, and with very little battle for what was going to be a controversial project, remember, they had the money in the bank to make the film. I mean, EMI had form with the Pythons. It had distributed Monty Python and the Holy Grail in cinemas and had done very well out of that. But also as part of the negotiation, and again, it must go down to, at this point, the Pythons couldn't believe their luck. EMI agreed to give up final cut of the film and also creative control over the project. There were still some internal issues that they needed to sort between the six of them. That certainly when it came to directing, there were two candidates to helm the film. There was Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones. And they'd stepped up previously and they co-directed the last movie. And it hadn't been a very happy experience for them, because what they quickly realised is co-directors don't by nature always get on. And they certainly didn't see eye to eye on parts of where Holy Grail was going. And so they concluded, as they came to the end of the experience of making Monty Python and the Holy Grail, that two directors was not necessarily the best way forward, and one of them had to back down. Now, I mentioned just before that Terry Gilliam had branched out and directed a film by himself at this point, which would be Jabberwocky. And Jabberwocky was made away from the Pythons, and he found the whole idea of directing people who he didn't know as well to be a lot easier. And so he agreed on Life of Brian that he would take a slightly backseat, that he would take on the production designer role on the film, and Terry Jones would then be its sole director. In terms of the casting, it was clear that the Six Pythons were all going to play a mix of roles in this. Then there was the who's going to play the title role of Brian. Now, John Cleese was interested in this, and it's important to note at this point that Fawlty Towers really was spiking, and his level of fame was above the others around this time. And so he was really the natural instant choice on the surface to play the lead character in the movie. But also the character, and Robert Sellers goes to this in his book, the character of Brian was always going to be the straight man in this, and they felt amongst them all that Graham Chapman was the best person for that, and that would free up the likes of Cleese, a naturally gifted comedian, to basically do his shtick in a variety of other supporting roles. And that's what happened. Everyone took on a bunch of roles in the film, and they sorted anyway the personnel issues and who was going to slot into which part of the film. For the role of Jesus, I mean, Cleese did have one idea that would have been a bit of stunt casting, because he thought they should get a movie star in. They should get someone really famous. And his suggestion was that George Lazenby, who had played James Bond in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, of course, would be the right fit to play Jesus in the film. But the argument came back that really it shouldn't be anyone recognisable here. That whilst it might look really good on the poster, where, I mean, Cleese had dreamed of the line, George Lazenby is Jesus, as part of the poster, they felt that they needed to go with an unknown, which is why Kenneth Colley would ultimately step in and play the part on screen. Still, the problems as they were coming up were being solved. And when they did some location scouting, I mean, they went around Morocco and decided that probably wasn't the right place. But they landed on Tunisia, and Tunisia had played home to two major productions in fairly recent times at this point. One of them was George Lucas's first Star Wars film. But more importantly for the Python team, Franco Zeffirelli, the acclaimed director Franco Zeffirelli, had made his Jesus of Nazareth television miniseries in Tunisia, and crucially had left loads of the sets behind and intact. And also the Python team could get access to some of the props and materials that Zeffirelli and the Jesus of Nazareth team had used. And this saved money on the budget, that they were able to go in and not only had basically someone done the pathfinding on whether this was a good location or not, which it clearly was, but there was also stuff that, I mean, they didn't have to build everything from scratch. And so production was motoring forward. April 1978 was going to be the start of filming, and the cast and crew were a couple of days away from flying out to Tunisia for the start of production when the chief executive of EMI, Lord Belfont, well, he finally got round to reading the script. More to the point, he'd read the script and had passed it to one or two other people because his confidence in this was suddenly shaken. It's just like, do you really want to be funding a religious comedy? And he courted opinion, and it would be fair to say he got incredibly spooked by the opinions that he courted, where he was advised in no uncertain terms to run a mile from the project, that this was going to be trouble. And so, with just days to go before the film was due to start its pre-production in Tunisia, the financing was pulled out completely. And this led producer John Goldston with a problem and a half. How can you plug the financing when everything else is in place, but it's the kind of controversial project that getting people to pay millions for and pay for it to be the most expensive Python movie today, this was going to be an uphill battle? And Goldston, for a start, didn't think he was going to find the answer in Britain. And so he and the Pythons jumped on a plane to America. And as Eric Idle described, he said, we went to see several people, all millionaires and billionaires, companies and corporations. And we'd sit there and do our pitch. And he said, we got in to see these people because Python was kind of popular, but nobody was very keen to finance the film. Once again, though, luck was on their side, because one person who was a huge fan of Monty Python was George Harrison of the Beatles, of course. But also he was a friend. He'd become a friend of Eric Idle, that the pair had met at a screening of Monty Python and the Holy Grail a couple of years before, and it just kept in touch. And whilst they were rattling their tins around Hollywood, word got to Eric Idle that George Harrison had jetted into town. And so Idle rang him up, and he just explained, well, they had a conversation, and with no expectations at all, he explained to Harrison, oh, we're in Hollywood to try and raise the money for this film. It's all fallen apart. We're a bit stuck. Don't quite know what we're going to do. And Harrison sat and listened to these conversations, and then he just said, yeah, I'll pay for it. No business plan, no proposals, no big company to report to. George Harrison just said, I really love Monty Python. I'll pay the bill for this film. This was unprecedented for a single individual to write a check of that magnitude to make a movie was unheard of in British cinema at this point. And as Robert Sellers recalls in the book, the Pythons went to see him, George Harrison, at his home in Hollywood. And Harrison, yeah, we're going to do this, directed him to his business manager, a man called Dennis O'Brien. And O'Brien, it was arranged, would meet the Python team in London and it would all be sorted out. And the price of the movie in American dollars was up to about $4 million. Let's just say, what, about £2.5 million. And the news got back to the other Pythons and that the film was back on. And I mean, they were jubilant, perhaps with the slight exception of John Cleese, who in the gap had agreed to do a different film with Peter Sellers. And he had to pull out of that one in the end. But Monty Python's Life of Brian was back on. And in the autumn of 1978, the cast and crew decamped to Tunisia. And on the 16th of September that year, filming could finally begin. Now, this was a half year delay on when it was originally ready to go. That was the impact of the pulling of the finance at such a late moment. But with the financing back together, they all got to the Tunisia location of it and filming could begin. Now, there were tensions on this one. It was an easier and calmer shoot than Holy Grail. But even though they weren't co-directors, there were still little clashes between Jones and Gilliam in particular, that Gilliam would design intricate stuff and gags and ideas into the sets that he felt Jones, and this is on one of the DVD commentaries as well, he just felt Jones just didn't make the most of that. And so they'd have the odd moments where they would spark. But on the whole, the shoot would run without a great deal of drama. It was pretty much done by the end of October 1978, after 41 days. They weren't even having to work that many long days on the film. They had planned this one incredibly well. And also, they got it ready to go 6 months before as well. So they knew what they were doing. As they pointed out, it was one of the most efficient productions that they'd ever done. I mean, George Harrison popped along at one point to see how his money was being spent. And he's roped in for a brief cameo role. They learned that Spike Milligan was staying in the vicinity and he was persuaded to come along. Although, whilst he is somewhere in the background of the film, he'd gone by the time it came to doing close-ups and things like that. They also benefited from the fact that Jesus of Nazareth had been filming in another way as well, because some of the local people in Tunisia had been extras on Franco Zeffirelli's production, and so it was no bother for them. They knew the score to be background artists in Monty Python's Life of Brian. Now, there were a couple of problems with the extras, not least that they're a little bit, they were explaining to Terry Jones at one point that Franco Zeffirelli did things in a different way. There's also a point in the film, I don't think I'm going very spoilery here, where Graham Chapman appears at a window naked. Now, this was against the religion of some of the people in the crowd, and so they promptly had to run away at that moment. There was also little bits of illness to contend with. I mean, John Cleese, in a sequence where he's put on a cross, he had a chest infection on that day and then realised he was going to be put on a cross for most of the day. And you had to ask if you needed to go to the toilet when you're up there for the day of filming. There was also the point where they realised they needed a song for the finale of the movie. And that was something that Eric Idle dashed back to his room and quickly put together. And he would perform the song in his hotel after a few glasses, which apparently is the version we get in the film as well. But with very little fanfare and very little fuss, and certainly with no clue just yet as to what was around the corner, the film wrapped up and would go back to the UK into post-production. And so it took a couple of months to get the first cut of the movie ready. But by early 1979, it was done. It came in at 2¾ hours. And they knew they needed to cut this back. And there have been one or two home media releases of Monty Python's Life of Brian that have included some of the stuff that they deleted out of the movie. But over the coming months, they gradually sculpted it down. And they got to the point where a final cut was ready. But at the point they were editing and building towards that final cut, so the fears were building that they were going to fall foul of blasphemy laws in the UK. And it was with that in mind that they made the decision not to open the film in Britain first. Instead, the premiere of Monty Python's Life of Brian would take place several months before it appeared in Britain, in New York City. It took place on August the 17th. It went well. And then 2 days later, the first blasphemy accusation surfaced. From that point onwards, they just barely stopped. And in fact, they were going on for years, even decades afterwards. Controversy would continue to surround this film. Now, the outrage grew more and more in the US, but then that helped the film, that the controversy was being widely reported. And when people are telling other people not to go and see a film because it's offensive, well, people want to go and see a film. And so the screen count for the initial release in America trebled off the back of that, and the Pythons had a hit on their hands. There was pressure, though, in the UK as this controversy swirled in America on the British Board of Film Censors, as it was known then, to not give Monty Python's Life of Brian a certificate at all, which would stop it being able to be released. But to its credit, the BBFC held out and did give it a certificate. It gave it a double A off the top of my head. But still, its UK distributor was really nervous about the film, and again, understandably so. So much so that it initially decided, but it's bound to be protested, it reasoned, so we may as well just open it in one cinema and just concentrate all the protest there, because we know it's coming, so let's do it. And so the Plaza Cinema in London was chosen, and in the second week of November 1979, Monty Python's Life of Brian played in the UK for the first time, and it absolutely smashed the record for the Plaza Cinema. Now, it's worth noting that the reviews for the film, whilst there were some who did come out against it, and some of the initial criticism, well, it centred heavily on the religious nature of the film, the religious themes that it explored. But conversely, people also saw the comedy in it. And there were some really strong reviews praising just what a funny and well done film this was. Now, these days, Life of Brian is regarded as a comedy classic, and it would be remiss of me to say that the reviews were at that point when it was originally released, but they're a little bit better than I was certainly expecting to see as I started researching this particular podcast. Even when it came to the UK, there was a lot of positive notices for the film. It's funny. It's a very, very, very funny film. And that was reflected in the reviews that were coming through. The demand to see it was growing and growing and growing. But the wide release in the UK wouldn't come until early 1980. And by that point, there was a real fervour for this one. But the way that the British classification system works is it allows local councils and local authorities to overrule what was at the time called the British Board of Film Censors, that the BBFC could issue a certificate, but a local authority had the power to change that certificate or ban a film or just toughen it up to some degree. And the protests and the press campaign to a degree was building to it with Life of Brian, and pressure was being exerted on local councils and local authorities. And in the end, in the UK, 39 local authorities either banned the film outright or gave it a tougher certificate than the one that the BBFC had deemed appropriate for it. Now, in America, there'd been bits where individual states in the US, particularly in the Bible Belt in America, had pulled the film, but this was slightly different. I mean, this was more microscopic in the way that censorship was being applied around the UK. And also, after the film's release, it's an infamous clip. John Cleese and Michael Palin found themselves on a BBC Two panel discussion show, and they found themselves arguing with a man called Malcolm Muggeridge and also the Bishop of Southwark. And the pair of them laid into Cleese and Palin on the show and were absolutely raging angry about the film and hurling all sorts of accusations at Cleese and Palin. And apparently, allegedly afterwards, the two pythons there found that the Muggeridge and the Bishop, that sounds like a band, doesn't it? Muggeridge and the Bishop had missed the start of the screening anyway, so they hadn't even seen the full film, was the allegation at that point. And Rowan Atkinson notably spoofed the exchange on Not the 9 o'clock News, the satirical TV show, the week after. But what was undeniable was, for all the controversy around Monty Python's Life of Brian, it was, the money was flowing in. This was a sensational hit, and it was making the kinds of money that Python films had not seen before. So in America, it became the highest grossing British film that year in the States. In the UK, I mean, considering that its release had been staggered across 1979 and 1980, gradually broadening out and broadening out, it would be a top 10 smash. And by the time its initial cinema run had been completed, the film had grossed $20 million around the world and has had several re-releases since. And it was a gigantic success, certainly against the production budget that was put in. One of the beneficiaries, ironically, of that was EMI in the UK. It played in the EMI cinema chain. There's a little dig just aimed at EMI personnel right near the end of the film as well. But it's the legacy of this spun off in a couple of different ways as well. And that's worth noting that for one, George Harrison was firmly in the movie business, and he set up his company Handmade Films. And again, I recommend the book Very Naughty Boys take that story up. And Handmade Films would be a small powerhouse in British film production over the decade or so that followed. And it was off the back of Life of Brian that it first came to light. Furthermore, the Python team, well, their legacy would continue, not just with the film. They'd go on to release a couple of other films as well. They'd release their Live at the Hollywood Bowl show in 1982. Monty Python's The Meaning of Life was in 1983. And then their reunion in 2014 was also filmed and released too. But the legacy of Life of Brian has gone on in, well, on the one hand, It's only recently that bans have been lifted in certain points in the UK, that there were one, I think Cornwall, the first showing in something like 30 years took place about a decade ago. But also, this is a film that with good reason regularly comes near the top, if not at the top, of lists of the finest comedy films, not just made in Britain, but around the world, that it's continued to be enjoyed for all that initial controversy for decades now. And in fact, the Pythons even took parts of it and put it into their West End and Broadway hit musical Spamalot too. And the legacy is ongoing. And also the legacy just of that song that Eric Idle penned, because that has in its own way gone on to have a bit of a life of its own. And what do you know, I might just play another clip of that towards the end of this episode. Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. A couple of bits and bobs then. It's just my little notice board here. Firstly, it's just my regular I am an independent bit, that the reason Film Stories has got this far without any big company backing or anything close to that, well, it's down to people like your good selves. So there are three ways you can support Film Stories, if this podcast, if you'd be keen to do so. First of all, is just simply subscribe to it at your podcast home of choice. That helps enormously. If you can leave, ideally, a hugely positive review, that also helps too. And then if you want to support us even more, I'm at Patreon, patreon.com/SimonBrew. If you go there and you can support us financially there, the money goes back into the Film Stories project. You get podcasts, you get the vast bulk of them early. You also find out all the little bits of gossip behind the scenes as well. And thank you so much for your support. Film Stories magazine, the latest issue, headlined by Reggie Yates's new film Pirates, is shipping now. You can order copies of all of our magazines and our sneakers Blu-ray at store.filmstories.co.uk. And I've got a Christmas special live show coming up in Birmingham on December the 22nd, 2021. Depending on when you're listening to this podcast, that may or may not be of use. Tickets are on sale now. It's at the Midlands Arts Centre in Birmingham. You can find more information on that at the Film Stories website, filmstories.co.uk. But that's enough notices. I'm going to crack on with the second of the two films I'm going to talk about in this episode. We're going forward to 2000 now. It's going to get a bit wet, this one. Let me just play you a brief clip from the trailer.
Mayday, mayday, mayday.
Hold tight!
Oh, my God.
Go, 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 go! Andrea
Dale, do you read me?
What you've got there then is a very soggy clip from 2000's The Perfect Storm, directed by Wolfgang Petersen, screenplay credited to William D. Whitliff, based on Sebastian Junger's book The Perfect Storm, and starring George Clooney, Mark Wahlberg, Diane Lane, William Fichtner, Karen Allen, Bob Gunton, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and John C. Reilly. So this is based on a true story, so let's start there. And a tragic true story that in the autumn of 1991, six fishermen in the Gloucester area of America in Massachusetts took their boat, which was called the Andrea Gale, out on a fishing run. It was relatively late in the fishing season, but they were looking to bring in a late bit of income. And when they went fishing, they found themselves up against an enormous storm, and their tiny boat was caught in the midst of waves of up to 100 feet. So this story, and it is a tragic story, I'm going to spoiler light as possible, but it's worth noting that just as with something like Apollo 13, a whole lot of people knew how this one ended before they got to either the book that Sebastian Junger would write or the film itself. Junger picked the story up and he turned it into a best-selling book called The Perfect Storm, which was hugely acclaimed. It was published in 1997, and Warner Brothers wasted very little time snapping up the movie rights to this. But then he had an idea of who might be interested in directing it and got in touch with Steven Spielberg. Now, Spielberg had worked with Warner Brothers extensively in the 80s, and he was about to work with them again on the film AI, based on Stanley Kubrick's story, of course, and I'll come to that in a future episode of the podcast. But the bearded one in this case had no intention of going and making another film on water. I mean, the story of him making Jaws and the perils of that shoot is very well known, to the point where at the time I'm recording this, it's now become a West End play. It's that infamous. And so Warner Brothers was looking around for who else could do it. Now, the 1990s had been very good to German director Wolfgang Petersen, who had burst onto the scene with his extraordinary 80s success Das Boot, and that was water-based. But in the 90s, he'd done the jump to Hollywood. I mean, he'd done Enemy Mine in the 1980s, I should note. But after the thriller Shattered, that's quite an underrated thriller, that is, if you can dig that out. He'd had a couple of big commercial hits. He'd directed Clint Eastwood in The Line of Fire. Then he'd directed Outbreak, a hugely troubled production that he steered to box office gold. And he was in post-production on a film called Air Force One, in which Hollywood had an awful lot of confidence, Harrison Ford starring that one, of course. And he'd become one of Hollywood's most in-demand commercial directors, and so was duly approached by Warner Brothers to see if he'd be interested in The Perfect Storm. Now, at the point he was approached, he was in post-production on Air Force One, hopefully not overseeing the dodgy bit in Air Force One where the plane lands on water. It's not a good effect, that. But he'd been given the book while he was in post-production, yet hadn't read it when Warner Brothers made its approach to Petersen to see if he'd want to direct. I mean, it was Das Boot, really, and the fact that he could turn commercial projects around that made him, in Warner Brothers' eyes, a strong candidate for it. Now, for Wolfgang Petersen, and there's the core of this to him, and it's reiterated in a Premiere magazine article from June 2000 that I've drawn on quite a lot for this podcast. The core was that he needed this to be as real as possible. If you are making a film about a fishing boat being caught in a storm, and it's based on a true story that you thus have to respect, you're going to have to put a fishing boat in the midst of a storm. As such, this is where William Whitliffe was brought in to adapt Younger's book for the screen, and he got some input from Bo Goldman as well. But the first draft that he turned in was said to be strong enough to instantly get the film a green light. And so this is one of the faster blockbuster productions, certainly for a standalone non-sequel, that I've covered in the Film Stories podcast. And Warner Brothers had a big tentpole movie that it could get ready for 2000. Now, the script would change some of the facts a little bit for the purposes of the tale, and it would ultimately lead to the film being billed as based on a true story rather than pretending to be any kind of definitive account. And this led to some wariness from the people in the Gloucester, Massachusetts area when it became known that Hollywood was going to make a film of a tragedy. It was very, very raw, particularly to that area of the world. I mean, it happened in 91, and what, 6-7 years later, Hollywood was going to be making a film about it all. More than that, Hollywood was looking for a movie star to lead it as well, because Warner Brothers had a top choice and Petersen had a top choice. Petersen's was Nicolas Cage, and this was immediately off the back of his action trilogy, Nicolas Cage, The Rock, Con Air and Face Off. Now, Warner Brothers, meanwhile, was keen to go with Mel Gibson, with whom it had worked lots of times on the Lethal Weapon films and Maverick and stuff such as that. I think Conspiracy Theory as well, it had just done with him. But whilst inquiries went into both of them had schedules that were already filling up. So Nicolas Cage was already committed to do the film Gone in 60 Seconds at this point, whilst Mel Gibson, a $25 million fee was discussed for him, was having to juggle this and a commitment to do a film for Roland Emmerich called The Patriot, which you may or may not remember. And as Gail Katz, the producer of The Perfect Storm, would say, we couldn't make a deal with Gibson. And she told this to the Los Angeles Times. She says it's about his deal versus the deal the studio wished to make. But there was, from what I can read, sufficient confidence that Gibson might be interested, that they started, that they were willing to relocate where they would shoot the film, were Gibson to sign on the dotted line. And actually, they'd started the journey for the boat they were going to use in the film was heading across America. It was sailing across towards Los Angeles on the off chance that Gibson said yes. And when he said no and instead committed to the Patriot, the boat had to turn around. Now, one person who had been interested, who'd been following it, who'd also got a relationship with Warner Brothers, was George Clooney. And George Clooney hadn't had his big movie breakthrough yet. That he'd done some high-profile films, such as Batman and Robin. He'd done From Dusk Till Dawn. He'd done the comedy One Fine Day. He'd done DreamWorks, his first live-action film, The Peacemaker. But none had gone gigantic. Well, Batman and Robin did good box office, but it's Batman and Robin, isn't it? And so he was still primarily best known for his work in the TV series ER at this point. But as I covered a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, he was just wrapped up making a film called Three Kings with David O. Russell. And he was aware of The Perfect Storm and he was interested in getting involved with this. Thing is, there's two male lead roles in the film. There's the experienced captain, Billy Tyne, who's towards his late 30s. And there's the younger male character, Bobby Shatford, who was in his 20s. And Clooney wanted to play the younger character. And Wolfgang Petersen just wasn't having it. Now, Clooney had apparently got a misconception that captains of fishing vessels tended to be much older, and so he wasn't expecting Tyne to be in his 30s. But Petersen did go to Clooney and say, you should be taking on the older role now. And also, the older role is a slightly darker character, a bit more rough around the edges. And Clooney, in the end, agreed to take that part on. He would do it for what turned out to be a bargain sum of $10 million as well, far cheaper than the alternatives that both Petersen and Warner Brothers had been exploring and that Warner Brothers was happy to pay for. With Clooney on board, he then threw in the name of Mark Wahlberg to take on the role of Bobby Shatford. Now, Mark Wahlberg, at this point in his career, he'd had one big breakthrough film role, which was Paul Thomas Anderson's wonderful Boogie Nights. But that hadn't been a monster box office success. That had been a hit on the art circuit primarily. I love the film Boogie Nights. Wahlberg is very good in it. But he'd not had a commercial hit. And to the mainstream audience, he was still best known for, let's just say, music and underwear at this point. Now, he'd shot Three Kings at this point as well, alongside Clooney, but that hadn't come out. It was still in post-production. And so Warner Brothers had to choose whether to take a gamble here. Because if Three Kings came out and didn't do well, and there's Clooney and Wahlberg's names on the poster of that, well, it would have exactly the same two names on the poster of its big film for summer of 2000. And that was the risk it was taking. It was genuine concern that Three Kings might do The Perfect Storm damage, although, as it turned out, the opposite was true. Petersen did meet with Wahlberg, though, and he was taken with him, and they pressed ahead with the casting of him. Also joining the ensemble was Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. Her name isn't mentioned enough, and she's put in some really strong performances in films over her years. But she was one of those who came to the project utterly unaware of the book. She was living in London at the time that the offer came in. But she had the experience of already having made one huge film on water. And boy, am I coming to this in a future podcast. James Cameron's The Abyss. And so she was one of the few members of the cast who signed up for the film with some idea of what they were letting themselves in for. Now, Entertainment Weekly noted that in an era where Hollywood studios were already looking to mitigate the risks of their project by bringing on co-financing partners, this was one where Warner Brothers decided to take the whole hit itself. That the budget for this was going to be $120 million. And instead of, as with Titanic, which was shared between Paramount and Fox, for instance, instead of looking for just a bit of risk aversion, it just decided it was going to go for it. Petersen brought in John Seal to be his director of photography. He brought in William Sandell to be the production designer. The speed the project was coming together at meant that they were soon deep into pre-production. And they had 3.5 months to get it ready, and they storyboarded everything. They knew that the water sequences were going to be complex. They had to know before they went in what they needed in the camera to make this film work. And they also knew this was going to be heavily reliant on post-production come the end of it and the work of the effects house Industrial Light and Magic, ILM, to its chums. While all this was being prepared, Mark Wahlberg moved to Gloucester, not the British Gloucester, the Massachusetts Gloucester. And he would be there weeks in advance, at that point relatively an unknown. And he really wanted to ingratiate himself in the area and with the local people, to the point where he moved into the room where Bobby Shatford had lived. He went out to fish with the local fishermen and learned. They taught him the ropes, apparently not very sympathetically. But also, there was detection there that the locals were still wary of the telling of this story. Wahlberg going there in advance certainly helped soften that, and he was soon embraced. And he went out of his way to assure Shatford's family that what he wasn't trying to do was depict their son. Rather, he was approaching it as he's playing a fisherman in the story. So it would be a variant of that. And that did reportedly give them assurance. Now, Clooney couldn't get there quite as early because he'd managed to slot another film in. And this marked a 6-year run that he was coming to the end of, where he was just going from project to project to project. So off the back of Three Kings, he went off to shoot Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Wonderful film that is, for the Coen brothers. And then only when he was done with that, he went straight on to The Perfect Storm, which was going to be a very, very intense a few months of his life. But he too found the support of the local town as well. And the fears of Hollywood descending were soon dissipating. And Clooney would put in the hours. He would be taught how to dock a boat properly, for instance. And he would work with the locals just to get into the character and into the role, but also to befriend the people in the town. So that by the time the camera started rolling on the 26th of July 1999, the production was warmly welcomed. Now, it wasn't going to be in the Gloucester area for long, but it did shoot there for the first 2-3 weeks. And filming needed a ship to recreate the Andrea Gale. And so what happened is the production team secured a similar boat called the Lady Grace and redressed that boat. And imagine how that must have been for the locals, seeing a boat that looked like an absolute spit for one at the heart of this very dark story, suddenly back in the town's harbour. The boat had cost $250,000 to make, and they shot for a couple of weeks in the seas off the coast of Gloucester. And right throughout this production, right from these early days, it would be fair to say that vomit was not in short supply. Just to add extra difficulties as well, in the midst of the location shoot in Massachusetts, Hurricane Floyd hit. And when Peterson saw this as well, he realised here was an opportunity to get some actual footage of a real storm. And he'd seen at first hand then the impact that a real storm could have. And he was determined to get some of that in the character. So the cast and crew duly loaded up the day after this massive storm had hit the area to get extra material. Vomit was not in short supply. After a couple of weeks, the production went to do the really, really tricky stuff back at the Warner Brothers lot in Hollywood. Now, lots of the water sequences that you see in The Perfect Storm were actually shot on the sound stages in LA rather than out at sea. Lessons were learned from Jaws. They used huge water tanks, one that had been used for a film called The Old Man and the Sea, for instance. But those water tanks that they had on the Warner Brothers lot were not big enough for this film. And at Peterson's request, they were made much deeper. They also had a gimbal put into the midst of it so that they could mount a boat on that and control it and hydraulically move it around. They could move it up to 18 feet via remote control. And the actors were thus put into this boat in the middle of this huge water tank that they had to be ferried out to the boat in the middle of it. Such was the size of the tank. And basically they had, 100 mile per hour wind machine aimed at them. They had water cannons blasted at them, and it was a fairly intense physical production for the cast that led to lots and lots of injuries being picked up. Not huge ones, but notable ones. There were sprains and bits and bobs. There was one with Wahlberg's ear. I'll come to that in a second. But one of the things that I found particularly interesting about the water tank is they needed blue screen with this as well. And so at the time, it had what was said to be one of the biggest blue screens ever used on a movie, 60 feet by 360 feet, to put the blue screen over the tank to create the effects that they needed. In turn, because of the blue screen they were using, they needed extra strong lighting as well. And it's really rare when researching a film that you find out how much the lighting cost on a movie. That's not one of the budget lines you tend to get. You tend to find out how much location shot was, or how much a director was paid or an actor was paid. But on The Perfect Storm, the lighting was required to such intensity that apparently accounted for $1.5 million of the film's budget. Peterson was very much putting his actors through this for real as much as possible. And that Wahlberg injury actually was an earplug, that a water cannon hit it and blew it too deep into Mark Wahlberg's ears, to the point where he was told he was going to need an operation to get it out of his ear with any degree of comfort. Such was the schedule that the film was on, he just told them to rip it out. Ow. Wahlberg also revealed in that premiere article that his character does so much screaming in the film that he got polyps on his vocal cords as well, which wasn't quite the injury he was expecting going in. But then it was left to Clooney to explain to the Los Angeles Times about getting the authenticity of it all right. And he said that there's that much freedom when you're in Los Angeles shooting the movie, but when you're with the people, it's interesting. It's just like, so on a normal film, he said a writer could put a line in like, yeah, my ex-wife is holding me up for alimony, because it would be something that would force a person to go out on the job. But that ex-wife, in the case of this film, actually lives in the town. And if you're going to do a giant movie that's going to open up for the 4th of July, there is a responsibility that if they're changing lines that characters would have been saying in this film, they had to track down the real people and just get sign off that those lines were appropriate to them. Production would ultimately wrap up on the 23rd of December 1999, and that gave Industrial Light and Magic 6 months, really, to get the effects work in place. And this is what really ultimately tipped the bill for the Perfect Storm over $100 million, was the challenge of recreating not just convincing water on screen digitally, and I refer you back to Air Force One a couple of years before, which I just think is a standout, very unconvincing shot, but they had to get these huge crashing waves to feel right as well and to look right. These were being done in a computer. So there was a lot of pathfinding here. There was a lot of groundbreaking that ILM needed to do, and it took months of work. Director of photography John Seal had gone back to his home in Sydney while it was ongoing, and Wolfgang Petersen was in the edit suite, and they were, I mean footage was being sent to Seal at his home, and he and Petersen were being really, really nitpicky over it, much sometimes to the frustration of ILM. But the filmmakers were insistent they didn't want Hollywood waves. This couldn't look special effects. This was a real story, and they had to do it properly. I would nonetheless suggest that what Warner Brothers did with, a really hugely successful marketing campaign as well, is it played on the size of that wave. So this was a rare project, really, in Hollywood, that in the mid-90s we saw the move towards special effects movies without stars in. In the case of The Perfect Storm, this had special effects and stars. And if you look at the poster of the film, though, it's clear what the hierarchy was, because even though by this time Three Kings had come out and been a success, the poster is a picture of the wave with the boat going up a wave. You don't see Clooney's face, you don't see Wahlberg's face. It is selling the special effect. The trailer sells the special effects, and I remember it playing time and time again that summer, and it sells it hard, and it was that the film was sold as. Now, when the film made it to critics, and it was lined up for release in June the 30th, 2000, so ready for the July the 4th weekend in the States, they were more drawn to the special effects as well, really, that it was felt that the actual human story had been relegated somewhat in favour of a big summer tentpole, that the drama side of it hadn't quite worked, the characters weren't really coming across, and whilst ultimately, technically, it was astounding to the point that it got Oscar nominations for its sound and for those visual effects. Gladiator won both of those, as I should point out. The actual drama side of it was just felt to be lacking. Nonetheless, this was a big summer blockbuster, being sold as a big summer blockbuster, and this approach worked. That the opening weekend for the movie, it went up, wouldn't you know it, against The Patriot with Mel Gibson and Roland Emmerich. The Perfect Storm won this by distance. The Patriot opened in second place with 22.4 million on its way to 113 million in the US and 215 million worldwide. The Perfect Storm, meanwhile, opened with 41.3 million on its way to 182 million in the US, 146 overseas, for 328 million worldwide. The other films it was up against, well, the top 10 that week had Jim Carrey and Me, Myself and Irene. It had Aardman's Chicken Run at fourth. Robert De Niro's infamous performance in The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle did not ignite the box office. That landed in fifth that year. Gone in 60 Seconds had done all right. That had come out a couple of weeks before. Mission Impossible 2 was around. Gladiator was hanging around after a couple of months. Samuel L. Jackson in Shaft as well. Those were the kind of films that were around. In fact, the week after The Perfect Storm came out, and it held its box office quite well, the first scary movie would come and be the surprise hit of the summer. Nonetheless, The Perfect Storm hit big. Warner Brothers certainly won its gamble to fund the movie by itself, and the pairing of Clooney and Wahlberg would prove to be the right choice. The film's legacy, though, I just think it's pretty much a forgotten blockbuster now. And I think that's probably about right. I don't actually love the film an awful lot. I remember being quite disappointed when I saw it myself when it came out. But it was a really interesting moment in Hollywood that was Warner Brothers kind of trying a variety of new and old methods to get a film over the line. And from a commercial point of view, it worked. Wolfgang Peterson would reunite with the studio for Troy a few years later. And in terms of George Clooney's movie career, this was one of the films really that rocket fueled it. That the success of Three Kings had done that, to then have The Perfect Storm come out a little while afterwards and also be a huge success. That also helped raise his profile. And then, I mean, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That didn't turn out bad either. Which all brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you can tolerate more of my waffling, I'm on Twitter at Simon Brew. The entire podcast project, Film Stories Project, is on Twitter at Film Stories Pod. Patreon.com/Simon Brew if you want to support us. If you want a daily, every weekday, a dose of movie news, reviews, all sorts of bits and bobs, you can go to filmstories.co.uk. Our shop is at store.filmstories.co.uk. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. We're on YouTube at youtube.com/filmstories. And again, I'm live in Birmingham again on the 22nd of December for my Christmas special show. Most important thing, though, as always, is that you all take care. You all look after yourselves. I thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with another bunch of film stories. But for now, I'm going to hand you back to the Python team. Bye bye. Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.